in a moment of weakness or senile dementia, which I think I'm suffering from, I volunteered to lead the forum tonight on the price we have to pay for love, which is separation. And I speak with firsthand knowledge. And joining me is Evelyn Smith, who teaches at Whitworth. And even though she retired, they hired her back to still come back and teach death and dying. More than one person came to me today and said, I don't want to come to your session tonight. I've had enough of grief. We're discussing tonight separation in many forms, and perhaps autobiographically I can give you some of this, and Evelyn will take over if I cave in, because I'm still suffering from acute grief, and I've spent a good deal of the day grieving, as I've read again some of the 400 or 500 letters that we have received in the last 2 months. By separation, I mean separation from something or someone you really loved. I mentioned some of this in my session today on animals. Many people equate their animal to that of a child, and when they lose it, the grief they suffer is very similar in many respects to that of losing a child. And I want you to remember that. It isn't some screwy person that's demented, that's weeping over an animal. It is very real. And to diminish its reality is doing them a great disfavor. It may be separation by divorce. It may be separation like I experienced in the war when I was separated from my wife for 31 or 2 months, a significant part of it in prison camp. It might be the separation that you have when you lose your hearing, as my wife did. That is a great loss. So I'm speaking of many losses. Oh, and I've lost my parents died in combat. In the combat that I was in, I made a living fighting and killing people for a time. And I lost some of my best friends. And I grieved over them. Over a year ago, one who was sort of my daughter died at 34. She was a Chicano who I'd helped early on. I had employed her. She was the daughter of a Chicano who was illiterate. She was one of 10 children. And she didn't know her father. I guess I was the closest thing she had for a father. And she took her master's with me, and I helped her, and she got into school of medicine, graduated and went into medicine. And at the age of 34, she died. And just 2 months ago tomorrow, our older daughter, at the age of 34, died. So I know what it is. And I thought it would be helpful if I shared with you some of the pain of this, so that you, I know some of you have incurred grief greater than mine, although there's few things that cause greater grief than loss of a child. The only grief that would be greater perhaps is never to have had them. And I want you to think about that. Now, you have to appreciate that grief is a very real thing, and it's very insidious. And I consider myself, because I have counseled with grieving people because of my position of responsibility in many situations, that I had many people, somebody was always dying, and they were close to somebody that was close to me, or if I didn't know them, it was my responsibility also to counsel with them and to write to them and to mourn with them and to empathize with them. And I didn't realize how I was giving them a great deal of advice, such as you must carry on. Yeah. I didn't know how tough that was till everything turns to ashes and you just don't give a damn anymore. But you gotta fight it. The easiest thing is to give up. There are many times when I would have liked to have given up. It was much easier to die than to live. But that isn't our assignment. And you must realize that people who have gone through separation, no matter what it is, have a much higher risk of disease and death. The mortality and the incidence of disease is much, much higher. It's a real thing. And I'm a pretty tough guy in many ways. Although my ability to withstand stress is diminished remarkably, and this happens to you when you get old. I think you're sort of issued a bucket of resistance to stress, and my bucket is about used up. I must admit this. I can't take stress like I used to. But what happened to me, and I had many assignments, because when our daughter died, I was going to a national convention where I had, I think, 3 presentations or 4. And then the next Sunday I had to preach a sermon in the Presbyterian Church. And then I had to go to an international congress where I had 3 responsibilities. I think it was very important that I carried on, and my wife insisted that I carry on with these. Although I did go home early from one meeting to be with her because she requested that. But what happens to you is that you eating is like nothing. I mean, you don't care about eating. And it doesn't taste very good, so you don't eat very much. And you don't sleep very much. And what happens to you then is pretty soon you can hardly walk a block. And when I went to Vancouver to an international meeting, I wasn't sure if I could walk a block. I didn't know what was happening to me until I got a hold of myself and says, you know, you got to hang in there, and you got to eat, and you got to face life. And face it, I did. Well, at least I'm trying to. There was much help for this. And I guess the people, well, there was much help, including from many of you people here. I guess the most help come from those who have gone through the same thing. And on all adversity, you must thank God for adversity, because it should help you to then be able to deal with these situations. I can now empathize with those who are hard of hearing because I'm living with it. Far better than I could before, although I had worked with them. I know how it is to be in prison, so I can deal with people in prison. Because I know what it is to lock the door, have the door locked behind you of which you do not have a key. And many other experiences I've had. And one of the people, and I hesitate to single out anyone, but I guess one of the people or a couple of the people that helped me the most in this, because they had gone through it, was Al Rognes, who many of you know, one of the great preachers of our time, and who lost a son at the age of 24. I will close tonight's meeting with a eulogy that he wrote for him, which is one of the greatest eulogies probably ever written. And he called me, and he also wrote me 2 letters. We shy away from death in our society a great deal. I think this was explained in a letter that our daughter wrote to her church. She wrote many letters. She was an outstanding writer. I've been thinking about life and death all day today. One of my students died yesterday after a very short, strange illness. He was one of the intelligent troublemakers. Our daughter was quit her job and paid her own way to be a volunteer in a mission school in the Cameroon. She'd always wanted to go to Africa to save Africa ever since she was a little girl. He was one of, as I say, he was one of the intelligent troublemakers as opposed to the stupid troublemakers in his class last year. I was thinking today, I'm sure he's a student I had the most physical contact with last year. I was always pushing him back into his seat and holding his seat and holding him there. And we had verbal battles every day. Sit down, Mabala. Be quiet, Mabala. Where is your homework? Oh, why didn't you do it ad infinitum and repeatum ad nauseum? I've been feeling so sad ever since he died, and my cheeks are beginning to get chapped from the tears. The kids were subdued today, and the teachers who taught him last year, not one had a smile on their face all day. 14 years is old is so young to die. I remember a theme he wrote for me last year about the last time he'd been to his village. I remember crying as I read it because they were so happy to see him. And then after the whole holiday was over, his father cried to see him go, and so did his mother and all his brothers and sisters. And Mabala cried too, because he loved them and school was so far away from them. The theme was so simple and sensitive, so much at variance with his behavior in the classroom, that I couldn't help but ponder over it a bit, while we're all crying again at this newest and longer separation. As I was walking home from school today, basking in the sunshine, I couldn't help crying out to God how terrible it was that Mabala would never feel the sunshine on his cheeks again. But then who knows? The chapel service today was very short and powerful. The chaplain said something about, since Mabala had loved Jesus, he's happy now. That we are sad because we miss him, and that we don't have to fear death because Jesus conquered it. And salvation is there now for any of us who asked for it. There's nothing like a death right in front of you, almost, to make you receptive to really listening to the messages like that. Maybe that's why sometimes life in America gets so trivial and banal, because we aren't close to death the way we are here. So we can ignore questions that concern the meaning of life and death. I've been thinking of staying another year, but I'm not sure now. Kids are always dying here, and I can't bear to go through it again. Almost every year a student dies at the college. Last year it was a student I didn't know, so it didn't hit me. Now I know almost all of them and want to think of them of all having a bright future here on earth. I don't want to mourn anymore. I'd rather go home where death is hidden away and the people who die are strangers in the newspaper. I came here to broaden my outlook. First, my kitten died. One morning he's lively and supple and warm in my hands, and when I come home from school I picked him up all cold and stiff and hard with ants eating his eyes. That was hard for me. I've had pets die before, but I've never held them in my arms and thrown them down the garbage hole. And now to have Mabala die, that's very hard indeed. It makes me ponder how broad an outlook God wants me to have. Please, God, I don't want to be any broader. Are you listening? Now, I would like to share with you some of a few of the writings, and I'll comment on them as to the meaning for me, with the intent that it will help you face grief. Because if you haven't faced it, you will. Because the ultimate statistic is that one out of one dies. Our Lord evidently wanted us to concentrate on the present and not be lost in either memories of the past or the fantasies of the future. Be not anxious for tomorrow, he said. And when you pray, say, give us this day our daily bread. And further, leave the dead to bury their own dead. But the present cannot be divorced from the recollections of the past or from the hopes of the future. Life is one piece. Like a river, any segment is a flowing part of the whole. Death does strange things. During the 2 years when our son was in England studying, and his son, like our daughter, was away for 2 years. And during his 2 years that he was studying, he was often in our minds, of course, but not more often than our other five children, or in our case, our other two. Upon his death, he seemed to be constantly in our minds. He haunted us. Night and day, there was hardly a moment when immediate pressures did not demand attention, but the memories of him did not surge into view. You see, when people die, they seem to invade the mind the more. But the ache and the emptiness is there, for we are so deeply tied to the touch of a hand, a gleam in the eye, and the sound of a voice. In retrospect, I don't see how it could have been any different. There came a time, however, when we had to choose. Would we actually cultivate this somewhat eerie presence? Would we deliberately blot out his memories? Would we talk about him on every possible occasion, or would we never mention him? And we faced this. You know, and you can't keep dwelling on it. It helped to think that he was not really God. He had been on the other side of the Atlantic, and now he is on the other side of death. But he lived. His life was not extinguished like a flame of a candle. The Lord had given him a resurrection. He belonged to the great company on the other side. The continuity of life which he had had with us and with which death had severed had been restored. We could not write to him or he to us, but even on earth we had not been dependent on letters or on seeing him. Our lives were tied together, explicit communication or not, and they still are. Of course, we miss her letters because they were so unusual. By not letting death be a morbid end, we achieved a proper place for our memories. They give us both pain and joy, now mostly joy, because for him it has been, I guess, about 17 years. Whenever the family is together, we move in and out of conversation about him almost as naturally as we do about our children still living. That's just like Paul. Remember how he would always forget where his billfold or his cufflinks were? Memories are too important, too rich to exclude from life. The capacity to remember is a great gift from God. Past, present, and future belong together. But you can't overemphasize the past or the future. Another very important thing in the Christian community, and I guess that's why our daughter found what I call querencia. Querencia is a very good Spanish word. It's where you find home. She found home not only our home, but she found home here at Holden as an extended community of Christians. This was very meaningful to her, and the other place that was querencia for her was in the Cameroon. Her house was always open, as were other houses open to her. She was in extended community. She has always identified with the poor and the disenfranchised. Perhaps I should read something to you. It was in her application, and I didn't know it until after she died. I feel, and this was in her application for Lutheran
mission work.
Yeah. I forgot the name of it. I feel that as a Christian, I should live simply so that I can more easily identify with the poor and the oppressed. Volunteer service is a perfect means to do this, as I will be earning no money to give a false sense of security. I am encouraged in the fellowship of others, and I feel a strong call to align myself with the disenfranchised as Jesus did. Now, you are doing me a favor tonight, in a way, because you are listening to me articulate my grief. And I'm going to get to that in a minute, but I recall one of the great Christian psychiatrists of the world is Paul Tournier. He is a friend of mine. I have had two meetings with him. On one of my meetings with him, I asked him many questions, and he had a very quick answer through a French interpreter. And then I said, what do you tell a person? And I had just gone through this, because dear friends had lost their firstborn, 27 months, who drowned in the neighbor's pool. I says, what do you tell them? Or I says, what do you tell this person who has just called me from Lutheran World Federation here in Geneva? I'm a friend of Karl Miles, and this was a friend of his who I didn't know. He had three children, and his, like us, they had a middle daughter whose name was Karen. And they had just diagnosed leukemia. And he asked permission that he could talk to me because I've spent a good deal of my life on studying cancer. And he wanted to talk to someone about the prognosis. And so I said, certainly he can call me. And for about 45 minutes he was on the phone with me, part of it sobbing. And I says, what do you tell a person like this? And Paul Tournier did not give me a fast answer on this one. He thought for a while and he says, well, you must let them articulate their grief. The forgiveness of God is very important in this. The glory of the Christian faith is that it centers its message on forgiveness. One of the pictures of the New Testament is that of a courtroom with Christ as the judge of all, in heaven and on earth, and a man appearing before him for judgment. And the court has but one possible verdict, and that's guilty. And then a strange thing happens. The judge steps down from his bench and takes the sentence himself. In a sense, he exchanges places with the man. And he goes to his death for the man. He assumes the guilt of a man, of that man, and transfers the innocence of God to man. In the language of theology of the church, he imputes or attributes the righteousness of God to man. And now the man stands bewildered in the court. Suddenly he is innocent and the Lord is guilty. Man is acquitted and God is sentenced. This image is a very profound one. Although God is not only a judge, but he is our Father. And Jesus is more than a legal figure. He is our friend and our brother. It recognizes, however, the deep significance between good and evil in the universe. And it takes seriously that judgment is demanded and that we cannot brush aside the stark fact of right or wrong. It puts it bold relief, the mercy of God. God has himself suffered and died for us. And a forgiving God has paid the supreme price for being this kind of God. And the Christian church never would have survived the first century if Jesus had done no more in his life and death and resurrection than demonstrated to man how a noble life could be lived. That would not have been enough. We have seen all sorts of heroic people do that, and I could list a whole name, many names of them for you, including Paul. Instead, millions of people these many centuries have believed that Jesus brought forgiveness of sins to the world. Man now, the forgiven one, attained through Jesus' death the right to be restored to the Father and to live with him sinless forevermore. God has risked everything, not on badgering man with judgment, but on winning him and luring him with his love. And then the art of comfort. How, as a friend, will you comfort someone in need? Most of us are really bunglers. Huh? And I'm sure you've all asked, you know, what words should I use? We may be even afraid to try and we stand off to the sides, or we think of some important thing over there to do. Our words, if we offer them, seem clumsy and empty. It is not always as easy with other sorts of tragedy, including death, to help out. How do you help someone whose whole world seems to have dropped out from under them and who is on the brink of despair? If you are to weep with those who weep, how do you do it? Now, one simple and effective way is to be at their side. Quite apart from anything you say, your presence is a language of sorrow and of love. And it may be the most eloquent language for the moment. The Bible says that when Job's comforters came to him in his hour of overwhelming loss and pain, they sat with him for 7 days and seven nights without saying a word, because they saw that his grief was great. And that was the kindest thing they did. For if you'll recall, when they started to talk, they butched it all up. Huh? They blew it when they talked. And Rognes goes on, he says, I shall never forget that moment, the day after our son's death, when two of my dearest friends came, one from across the continent, and I saw them through the window coming toward the house. A dozen sermons on death would not have been as eloquent. A dozen sermons, and another friend, an eminent theologian, wrote a simple note of affection and said that the great words from God would at that moment probably carry no freight. But the time would come when they would become carriers of comfort again. And they have. To be surrounded by people who care is a great comfort. Now, I wrote many years ago, or several years ago, this. What does it mean to really care? Care has its roots in kara, which is a Gothic word meaning to lament, to grieve, to experience sorrow, to cry out. Caring, compassionate people who in our life have meant the most to us are often those who, instead of offering an assortment of advice, cures, or solutions, choose to share with us our pain and to touch our hurt with a gentle and tender hand. They are the friends who remain silent and listen to us in moments of despair, who can stay with us in our hour of grief. Such friends join us in acknowledging our own powerlessness when facing death, and admitting that they do not understand. They do not encourage us to run away from the pain. They do not busy themselves with trivial tasks, but they stand in the face of death together with us as we grieve. Now, Just a few more words. I've gone on longer than I planned on, but there are a few other things. The first response, well, it varies with the person. I imagine there is anger sometimes, and Evelyn will talk of some of this anger. I didn't really see the anger, but I've seen it in other people. There is denial. I still have trouble coming to terms that our daughter Karen and Gloria and are really gone. And I will probably have trouble forever with that. And then hopefully eventually come to terms, but there is frustration and there is a sense of loss. So often there is a sense of guilt. And one of the advices I give that's probably the best advice is I don't want to ever hear you ever say, "What if?" What if I would have done this? What if I would have done that? You can kill yourself doing that, and it's fruitless. It's absolutely fruitless. Rognes wrote, while the excerpt from Karen's letters are marvelous, it never occurred to us how much it meant to both the missionaries and the people in Africa that she rested there. We made the decision that we would bury her there. And we did not realize at the time how much it meant to the Africans. Because you missionaries come and then you leave. You even take your bodies back with us. But leaving her body there, you leave her spirit and her soul and her body, which becomes part of them. And the earth where she is planted is sacred ground, forever a witness to them. And that is very important. You speak of the shadow still falling towards the west. My way of handling this is different from a wife. My wife has trouble articulating this grief. What I did, I wrote a lot of things. I wrote my wife a couple of letters, although I was there with her. But on my way home, I wrote her letters that would hopefully be comforting and how we should face this. And then I wrote two types of letters, one a very long one that I sent to my friends. Because it is very hard for me when you bring up the death to me, you see. It is better to have me bring it up to you. All right? So this is how I do that. But I had said, although we would give anything to have Karen with us again, we realize that it is not to be done. Or not to be. We are grateful that we had her on loan for as long as we did, 34 years. Though she left us before the shadows of life touched noon. Somewhere I have something to say about this, but you see, the time that you have here isn't important in reality. And I'll try to find this while you're talking. He says, you speak of the shadow still falling towards the west. In an image of Bob Ingersoll used at the grave of his brother who died before 35. Then he goes on to say, and yet may be the best, just in the happiest, sunniest hour of all the voyage, when eager winds are kissing every sail to dash against the unseen rock and an instant hear the billows roar above a sunken ship. Both your Karen and our Paul had the joy of the full sails as they met the unseen rock. It is we who sorrow, not they. It was Hebrews 12:1 that caught my spirits at the time. I pictured Paul and now Karen in the bleachers cheering us on. And they would not be happier to have us crippled by grief. We can't help grieving, but as you mentioned, we can carry on with added motivation, borrowing from some of the nobility that was theirs. On July 20th, Paul's birthday, Nora baked a chocolate cake, his favorite, as she has done every year. The initial wrenching pain of those first months have now gone, and he doesn't press in upon our memories as persistently as then, but now and then there surges up a memory that makes you want to cry again, but their tears of gratitude as much as sorrow. And I have several more, but now it's your turn, Evelyn. to talk to us.
I hardly know what to say in the face of what we've been listening to. I know you're as moved as I am with the openness and the way in which this whole experience has been shared with us. I'll tell you a little bit about where I've come from and a few of the experiences that I have had. Nothing quite as close or as deep recently as what we've been listening to together. I was overseas. I was in Formosa when my father died in 1958, and I was separated from my family at that time. And before I went on this trip, I was going to a World Christian Education Convention in Tokyo, and my parents were as thrilled as they could be for me to have this experience. And just before I left, my mother said, "Evelyn, Daddy and I have been talking, and if anything should happen to one of us while you're on this trip, we don't want you to come home. We have wanted you to have this trip so much as if we ourselves were going." And I brushed it off and said, "Oh, Mother, nothing's going to happen." And they were both in good health at the time. But my father died very suddenly of a heart attack while I was on that trip. And when the telephone call came, I was in Formosa in Taiwan. And I said, "Mother, do you want me to come?" That was my first thought. And she said, "No." My brother and sister were both there. And I didn't come. But I suffered the grief of separation from sharing an experience with my family at a time when family should be together. It was a very difficult time to be apart from them during this experience. Well, after I returned, which was after the convention was over, this was before the convention, and my mother moved to Spokane from California to live with me, and live with me for 20 years before she died. And she was ill for quite a long period of time. And it was, well, a few years before she died, several years before she died, that I started teaching the course on death and dying at Whitworth. And I'm not going to go into how I got into this. It's another long story. But it's been a tremendous enrichment to my own life to have had this kind of study and this kind of sharing with students, because many of them have gone through some very, very difficult grief experiences in their lives and in their families. And this has been very rewarding. But also in my mother's and my relationship, the fact that I was teaching this course made a difference. And my mother made all the plans for everything, for her funeral, and everything was all done way ahead of time, partly because she was reading the books that I had for my course at school. But it made it much easier for me at the time of her death that she had taken care of this thing. She was in the hospital for about 4 months before she died. And I was teaching the course on death and dying at the college when she died. And I had debated, I had talked to the dean of the college about it, and he had said, "Maybe you should take this January off." And I said, "No, I feel like I need to share this, what I'm going through, with students." And I did. I shared very openly with my students, just almost like you've shared with us as freely tonight, only to lose a child is probably very different from losing a mother who was 85 years old and who had lived a rich, full life. But still, it's loss. And she'd lived with me for 20 years after my father had died. So it was a real separation and a real loss. But I shared with my students, and I was so moved because about 16 of them came to her service at our church. And most of them had never been to a funeral of any kind before that time. And we talked about what went into a service. We had with the students afterwards, and why we had the kinds of things in the service. It was a worship service, and why we had a worship service at the time of death, and where and the creed was used, and a regular service of worship that meant a great deal to us as a family because this was a part of our life. And students, one of the things I've required in my class, and I still do, is that they write a sympathy letter. You know, I don't know about you, but I've had a hard time sometimes writing a sympathy letter that really communicated what I wanted to communicate to someone at the time of loss. And so we talked about what goes into a sympathy letter to make it meaningful. What are the kinds of things that you share? Well, most of them wrote me sympathy letters that just were deeply moving and meant a great deal. But the kind of thing that meant as much as anything was to wake up one morning and see two students out shoveling snow in my driveway. They'd come over to help. A girl came over one day and knocked on the door. She says, "I can't do very much, but couldn't I clean house for you? I want to do something." And the ways in which they found to express their caring and their concern did so much for me during both the time of her illness and after the time of her death, because all through this time, students were just really tremendous. I was sharing with Dr. Bustad just a little while ago that I have been in Hawaii this summer. I had one of these $95 tickets that I couldn't afford to waste, and had a seminary classmate in Hawaii who was house-sitting in the home of friends there, who is a Baptist. And I went for a vacation, but I had the day after I got there, she said that the pastor of her church had died very suddenly of a heart attack. You know, did your daughter die July 16th? July 16th was the day that this 46-year-old pastor died in Hawaii. And the wife of the pastor had come back, gone to North Carolina for the service for her husband at home. They'd had one out there also, and had just returned at the time that we arrived in Hawaii. And I had several really close talks with her. I had never met her before, but she told me that she could share with me things she couldn't share with the congregation because they wouldn't understand. And she expressed to me that the thing that she was struggling with the most was her anger at her husband. She said, you know, for 6 weeks we tried to get him to go to the doctor. We knew he was having problems, and he didn't go. He did this to me and to our children. And she was hurting deeply because of the anger that she was feeling toward him. And I said to her, and sometimes it's very difficult to deal with some of these things because each person's an individual, and there's just no formula that you can give that's going to help everybody. But I said to her, you know, I don't think that's an uncommon kind of reaction. And I said, why don't you want to go to heaven? He said, well, my Auntie Helen went to heaven and her kids don't have a mother anymore. Oh. And you see the kinds of things that children pick up, and they need to talk to someone. And I told his parents about this. I said, did you know? They said, we didn't even know he picked up anything about this at all. We didn't know he was listening as we had our conversations about the death of his sister. And I said to them, it's important to include children.
It's very, very important. Yeah. And some of them have a different reaction, like Karin's cousin, who she was very close with, and her children. Our Karin had a special gift with children. She was a children's librarian. Yeah. And her cousin then was very, she was really worried about how her children would take Karin's death, because she'd been so close to them. And they said, well, I mean, she's the lucky one. She's in heaven now. I mean, and it was just like that, you see. I mean, it was.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Yeah. But sometimes they'll have thoughts afterwards, too.
Oh, yeah.
And the thing we have to do, I think, is to listen to where children are. I had a student at Whitworth whose sister had died. The sister was 20, and he was 22, was a senior. And the parents were given all kinds of sympathy by everyone. He came into my office, locked the door as he came in, and just broke down and sobbed. And he said, everybody thinks about mom and dad, but nobody thinks about me. It's my sister that died. My only sister. And he was hurting. He was suffering. And every time I have a chance, I tell parents, be sure that you don't exclude children from experiences of grief that you're going through. So often we want to shield children. And sometimes the concepts they get of death are very strange because we don't include them in the grief experience. Now, if we include them with real love, that makes a difference. Telling them something is different from sharing.
Or the older ones, you know, we always say, well, they're so strong and you don't have to worry about them. Karin's brother, who is older and is a physician and, of course, deals with this all the time, as cardiologists do. And there was a tendency, you see, you know, he's the tough one and he's the one that called me and took over and made all arrangements because he knows how to handle emergencies. But he needed help. All right, now it's your chance.
Yeah, let's give them a chance to talk. I've told them several things.
I'd like to mention that I know how you feel about losing your daughter. We lost our son, he was 38, in an electrical accident. And being a very emotional person, I already grieved. And the person who helped me the most was our local postmaster. He told me, Art, Don knew the Lord, and he's better off than we are. And I thought, true, he's ahead of us. He's better off than we are.
Very good.
I recall my mother died when I was 5. And I can see myself going out to the pump on my grandmother's farm. And my aunt said, you'll never see your mother again. And I said, oh, yes, I will, and I'll see her in heaven. And she said, well, that isn't in this life. And then it really struck me.
Yeah, she didn't really do you a favor.
No, she didn't. I really grieved then.
This is a very common concept of children, that death is temporary, and because of what they see on TV. You know, they see characters die, then they see them back on the screen again. And but they think of death as not being a permanent thing. It's very difficult.
This was many years ago. Yeah. No TV.
No TV then, no.
Isn't the most important thing that you can do in a situation like that is in essence be a good listener, to provide an atmosphere where they can
yeah.
communicate and talk.
I feel
they're the ones that have to get it off, aren't they?
I feel that way, and that you have presence, and the letters meant a lot to us, although I've spent a lot of hours crying over the letters when you have read 400 to 500 of them, and replying to many of them. I guess when this happened, and the word got around, the men in our society have difficulty with this, because they can't touch. We're suspect if we touch the men. The women are much better at this, and the women did much better by me. Save three people, there were three people in the first week who hugged me. That's the main thing they did, was to hug me, from people that I wouldn't have expected it from. I mean, you know, there was a macho type guy, but they sensed this, and that meant I'll never forget it. I'll never forget it.
A psychiatrist once said in a class I was going to that you needed a funeral or a memorial service in order for the person to get rid of their grief.
Yeah.
Because one of the class had remarked that if they just weren't going to do anything, just let it pass. And he said, well, you really need.
You probably want to address that, others may want to address that. This is often the instruction that you have to see the body put to rest, to put in the grave, to have finality to it. And this is the usual instruction. We counsel with this in veterinary medicine for children, that they put the body in the backyard and bury it. Sometimes you can't do that now in certain restrictions, but I think that is very helpful. In our case, this was a point that we had to face. I was of the opinion that it should be left there, that Karen should stay in the Cameroon where she had found Querentia, where she really found home and probably the happiest 2 years of her life. And it was a wise decision. But we did have, I think there is some problems with finality that you are talking about, although they were very kind about this. And in their society, they had a remarkable funeral, probably more so than we could have. I mean, they had continual vigil until she was born, night and day, until she was buried. It was a very large burial service. They couldn't accommodate everybody. And the grave diggers in a very poor society, of course, get paid for this. All of the grave diggers on her grave refused payment, which was, of course, a great testimony to her acceptance and her contribution to their community. Even the Muslims were around the periphery of the memorial service, and there were Catholics and Protestants. And in any community there is divisiveness, and she was one of those who helped heal it. And what they did for us was to give us a running account of the whole thing, not only by letter, by pictures of the whole grave and her grave. And we are setting up a special scholarship in her name there. And one of the things I have asked them to do is to Mabala, who is this little boy I read to you about, that they would send Mabala some extracts from her letter to her parents with her picture and tell her that Karen loved Mabala very much. And we are looking at a scholarship to continue this kind of commitment to the unfortunate there.
That's beautiful.
And the other thing we're looking at, and I think it's very important, and there's one in the audience who I've counseled with on this too, that you have a memorial, and it is often useful, and we are having a more modest memorial here at Holden. And one of the things we're looking at that Larry and I we're discussing with, is it Hayden?
Pat Hayden.
That one of the things here at Holden is, that meant so much to Karen is that many people could benefit from this as she and her sister Becky did, but are unable to make the trip here because they cannot afford it. And one of the things we're looking at is because there's a lot of African students in the United States who would be a great resource here, would have much to say us because we have much to learn from them, but they can't get here, and we probably look at something like that to bring certain of those here to do this. Now,
I was just going to say one other thing that I feel is tremendously important about a funeral or a memorial service, whichever you have, and that is the fact that you feel the support of the congregation. That's given to you as a family, as survivors. Letters do this for you, but it's the presence of these people that means so much at a time like this, and the expression of love that they give.
Can you share with me as a pastor how come many funerals are not in church but are in a home?
In a funeral home.
Yeah. 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 Sometimes we can't educate people to do this.
It takes education.
One of the things that I haven't mentioned, and I'm glad you brought this up. In my counseling up until this time, one of the great tapes in this tape library here is by Fritz Norstedt, who I haven't mentioned, whose daughter died at 28. And his account of this, how he, in the final days of her life, how they brought her home. And I was with Fritz just before I came up here, and I go to counsel with him as frequently as I can. And he told me about this a long time ago, and I'd certainly recommend this tape to you about him. But when she was in the hospital and they knew that it was a terminal cancer situation, her husband, Fritz's son-in-law, and he went to see her. And she ran him out of the hospital. And she says, "Until you face the reality of your own death, you can't help me." And my counsel is that we have to think about death. I mean, it's something we'd like to put away. Like Karen here writes that she can't stand it. But it's one of the things we have to face, and we must face the reality of our own death before we can really help someone. And I think if they went through this and thought about it, as you or your mother planned, you see, through this, if they plan ahead on this, and I have made certain of these arrangements myself, I think they wouldn't do, maybe they wouldn't do this. I don't know. Maybe there are others who can address that. Yes.
Our acquaintances I know that had died that had no church, and our pastors from our church, we'd have to get our pastors to go in and perform a ceremony. And of course, naturally, the funeral home was the place where it was occurred, yeah, rather than the church, because they had an open day, they didn't have a church home.
Yeah, it's very tragic. You see, most, I feel really bad. I feel very bad about losing our daughter. But I also am exceedingly fortunate that she was such a remarkable person. That in her 34 years, she had probably influenced more people for good than I have in 63 or most people at 80. And so I have the luxury of that other people don't. Through probably, I mean, it's a blessing, and it is not my fault, you see. But it is a gift of God. Ever since she was small, I knew she was a very unusual person, as if she was in another world. And when she left to Africa, I broke down and sobbed bitterly, because I was pretty sure I'd seen her for the last time.
Life is not measured by its duration, but by its donation.
That's a very good statement, and that's exactly what I was going to get to. I found this.
Oh, good.
Life is more than an accumulation of years. Its measure is essentially qualitative, not quantitative. Once we understand this, we may be less anxious about stretching out the years. Whether we live 5, 20, or 80 years, the measure of our worth must be a different standard than the interval between birth and death. The apparent tragedy of an early death will be seen in its proper perspective if we have clearly in mind what constitutes a meaningful life. Whether an automotive worker, a farmer, a builder of bridges, a man has dignity and worth which is measured by some standard apart from production. Man is important because God made him important, or her important. He or she is somebody, not because he or she has been a successful competitor in production and become wealthy or powerful. His or her dignity, his or her worth derived from quite another quarter. The exhilarating perspective of God has given us simply that at creation he endows a life with dignity and worth. Whether a child is retarded or grows up to be a brilliant scientist or philanthropist, his worth is assured. He is a prince in a royal house. Nothing can change that, years of achievement notwithstanding. He was somebody because God made him a somebody. That's what he said about his Paul, who at 24 hadn't been really in the productive area, you see. But he said he was somebody because God made him somebody. And whether it's a retarded child, and I'll probably have Vespers on Tuesday night, and I'll address this. What is a mongoloid child or a plant in a mental institution worth anything? They are. And so I'll be addressing that. Now, these final words. Just a few other letters. I've always felt that the true measure of life is made not by time, but by love. Love given and love received. Although this can't make your pain go away, it certainly speaks for the richness of Corinne's life. And then this from somebody I don't even know, but they were with Corinne. They said, Corinne and my daughter Robin were friends in the Cameroon. It was just a year and a half ago that we all traveled together at Christmas. Ever since our young son's death 5 years ago, Christmas has been a holiday to dread, but thanks to Corinne, Chris and Robin, that Christmas was joyful and fun. Karin's humor in particular often had me in tears from laughter. She had a marvelous dry wit and would often offer perceptibly funny comments, yet with a perfectly straight face. Moreover, of the five of us, she was the one who always kept her cool, no matter how vexing the situation. I recall one time being tired, hot, and miserable while waiting hours for a bush taxi, and then laughing when I noted Karin in her funny African hat, placidly sitting on a piece of luggage and calmly chatting with a small African child. Christmas Day, Karin and Chris made a picnic lunch and took us to a beautiful waterfall some miles from the mission. There we exchanged silly gifts and enjoyed the sunshine and the camaraderie. What could have been a very sad day for us, Karin helped to make the most pleasant one. Since then, I have fantasized a reunion. Well, I can't go into that. And at times, even in the ordinary, she knew how to bring out the extraordinary. She could see remarkable things in little things. And from our director here of our program, from the Rasmussens, we trust the time since her death has made even more poignant the joy that she brought to you. I'm certain it has been a hard time in the intensity of the loss. In all cases, it's all gathered up by God, who knows your loss as well as the feast of life that was Karin's. And then this very humorous story. I remember one particular instance, which is probably one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. Karin, Jim and Karin and Noss and David and Carlene and Kevin Peterson and I went to the airport to accompany someone. They were always saying goodbye to somebody. On the return trip, we were together in Jim Noyes' car, an old Peugeot station wagon. Karin started to tell the story of Rapunzel. I've heard her do this. She was a puppeteer. She did it in all her voices. And she could really frighten you with a witch's voice. It was awful. The old wicked witch, the young damsel, the handsome prince, and so forth. Well, needless to say, she had us all in stitches. Jim arrived home, but instead of stopping the car, he drove around the lawn, around and around the house until Karin finished her story. The Cameroonians have wondered to this day what those crazy American missionaries were doing, driving around and around for 10 minutes in the car, laughing on the lawn in front of Noss's house. You see. So that's the things we got to remember. And then these two final readings, one from Karin, her next to last letter to her church. The final one is here. I'll leave this if somebody wants to see it. It's also her last story to her church. Just a month before she died, was really a funny one. But here, this one. She was always dreaming and telling us very vividly about our dreams. Sometimes I almost got tired of them. Speaking of a dream, I had a strange one the other night. I was at a village market and I saw a man holding up some clothes for sale. The long white robes that men wear here. All of a sudden I felt such a longing, a deep craving for a white robe like that. The sun was hitting the robe so that it shone brilliantly white, almost blinding me with the reflection it was giving off the sun. And I went stumbling up to the man asking how much it was. I was sure that if I could wear a robe like that, so white, whiter than snow, I would somehow be closer to Jesus. But then I realized that wearing a white robe wouldn't do the trick, that it had to go deeper than that. And in a way, when I turned away from the man and left the robe there, I was disappointed. It would be so much easier to wear a white robe, wouldn't it, than to have a pure heart. I'll never forget that dream. It was so vivid. And now the eulogy by Rognes. He was only 24. He had been center on the football team, steersman on the crew, childhood, high school, Christian College, Oxford. The years had mounted upward in a spiraling crescendo. In George MacDonald's words, he was a gleam-faced, pure-eyed, strong-willed, high-hearted boy, and the rising plateaus were before him. Suddenly, his youth, his life was ended. The roar of a motor, a broken body on a city street. Youth is not a preparation for life. Youth is life itself. There is no time for rehearsal. The great play is on, Every day is another little block of time in which to live. To live, to love, to serve, to weep, to laugh. You cannot employ today only to set the stage for tomorrow. There may be no tomorrow. Long years ago, a youth of 33 writhed to his death on a cross. Across the centuries, this young man summons other young men and women to join him and to give him the vibrant, aspiring years of their youth. These years may be the only ones that can be given, for there may be no more. And what years they are, exuberant, gay, warm, sensitive, strong years. If the Lord can have these years, then he has captured the best. Perhaps these are enough for him. You may have 70 to give him. You may have but 80, or in our case, 74. Or in the case of Ginny up there, who's Ginny, the Ginny's corner, she had only 10+1. However long or short, having given him your years, when death makes his capricious attack, the Lord of the cross and the empty grave will set you on your feet again and put you to work in the imperishable sectors of his kingdom. And so ends the eulogy. We have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the skies. And I know with great assurance that our daughter is wearing that white robe.